Hey, this is Elizabeth.
This is Keisha.
Hi, this is Leslie Sullivan, and welcome to the Mustard Seed Podcast.
All right, well, welcome back to the table. Today we are going to, you have just Keisha and I again, no Leslie, because again, schedules are what they are right now. So it's just a kind of a, we're just kind of moving forward, and we know we are looking forward to when Leslie's back with us. You know, I always love her insight when we go through the books of the Bible and everything. I think she rounds us out pretty good.
Yeah. So, she's very knowledgeable.
Very. But today, because I know a lot of times when Leslie's not able to join us, you know, Keisha and I kind of take that opportunity to go through apologetics with everybody. And so that's something that we thought we'd kind of continue with today. So I know the last time that we discussed apologetics on the podcast, it was just a general overview, like, hey, this is what this is. Here's kind of the different divisions of it. Just a very good bird's eye view of what apologetics means. But today we're doing kind of, I think it's both of our favorite like division, just because it's extremely interesting. But it's the evidential apologetics.
Yeah. It's like jumping down a rabbit hole, you know? It's just where am I next? Yeah.
It's like, what else can I find? Who else found this? Let me see. Yeah. You know, so first off, because it's been a little bit since I know that we did our apologetics episode, I thought, you know, a kind of a brief review is that, again, apologetics is basically a systematic defense using reason and discourse. So it kind of originated from the Greek word apologia, which meant speaking in defense. And the aim is to provide a rational base for belief, counter objections, and persuade others of the truth. And there are different methods or divisions is what I was calling them earlier. You know, you have your classical apologetics, your presuppositional apologetics, Fideism. Not positive. It's one of those ones where I need somebody to say it out loud for me instead of me reading it, trying to read it phonetically. You know, and then there's evidential, which is, again, that's our topic for today. And that is a method of defending the Christian faith by using historical and external evidence to demonstrate the truth of Christianity. Basically, it also says particularly focusing on the resurrection of Jesus Christ as the central event, but it also argues that the events of the resurrection can be taken as evidence for God and the validity of Christ's claims rather than solely relying on philosophical arguments or personal experience.
Mm-hmm. You know, just to add a little bit, I had written down, a quote from Vadi
Bachman.
Yeah. Which I know you said you kind of started listening to. I really like him. But he said, you know, apologetics is knowing what you believe, why you believe it, and being able to communicate it in a awesome and effective way. Mm-hmm. I like that.
I do too. I really like, and I encourage everybody to search him. He's on, you can find him. He doesn't have his own specific podcast, but he's on a lot of different platforms.
Yeah.
And
he seems to be a guest in a lot of other apologetics.
And he won't put you to sleep. Let me just put it that way. When you're listening to him, he's very energetic and he's entertaining. Like, he's very knowledgeable, but it's not like in your face.
Yeah.
You can't understand what I'm saying to you.
He's very practical too.
Yeah. Very. I've really enjoyed listening to him. I actually sent it to Steve and he was like, yeah, I liked that. So when looking into apologetics, I didn't realize that people were very adamant about what one to stand on, and that if you didn't believe what they did, it was wrong, you know, or maybe just not fully in the truth. But I felt like all apologetics methods or topics all kind of just like the body of Christ kind of all work together for the good. You know,
it's like their approach, you know, it's like their viewpoint or how they start on it, but it really kind of seems the same.
Yeah.
It's like they harp more on one thing than another thing, I think. Mm-hmm. But you know, like the classical and the evidential method, they're more of I heard one person explain it as it's like a, you know, a bottom up approach. Like, here's the evidence. This shows that God exists. So therefore God exists. While like the presuppositional, I didn't say that right.
That's how I say it.
Okay. It's more of a start with a top down approach. Mm-hmm. God exists because God exists, A, B, and C. So,
yeah,
I think it's just kind of how they approach, but they are very argumentative about it.
They are. And I just like the topic as a whole. I didn't realize that people say, pick your stance and stand on it. And I just feel like in all of them, there always has to be evidence, you know.
Yeah,
the evidence portion is pretty much, I felt like, kind of almost a foundation of them all. It's just,
yeah,
they all kind of go from there a little bit. And I know that's just me saying it right now when we haven't really gotten into them. And I don't know as much about all the other ones either. I can only tell you like kind of what the overviews of all the things that I've said, like what I've seen. But you know, until we really get into them, you know, in the coming weeks, you know, months, I won't really fully under grasp it either. I just know that this topic is, because you and I both like the history of it and the foundations of a lot of this stuff. This one was the most interesting and most fun. And
yeah,
you know, this was, I know, the one we wanted to start with.
And you know what? I said they kind of argue, and I think they do to a point, but I think they're also, they seem kind of respectful of each other and respectful of each other. But it's like, it can almost become a standoffish for some people once you kind of get into it.
Yeah.
And then there's also kind of the really philosophical approach too, like, you know, and that one tires me.
Yeah, that one will be interesting when we get there. Because it's gonna be hard, and that one might be one like we do Daniel. Like, let me just give you the overview of this one a little bit.
Yeah.
And we'll dig into it later when we better understand it.
Let me cite someone a lot.
Yeah. Not that I'm already not doing that here anyway.
But my brain don't go very well with the philosophy.
You know, I get it. I wasn't a philosophy major for a reason.
Yeah. I understand it's needed.
Yes.
It really is.
Yes.
But it seems to get very wordy.
It does, but R.C. Sproul does talk about that, and he does a very good job at making me be able to understand it, because his, I have his audio book, but it's not, it's funny because it's the book that I own, but the audio is him giving a lecture, so it's not him reading the book. So it's the Defending Your Faith, and it's not him reading the book to you, or it's not an author or a narrator reading it to you. It's R.C. Sproul giving his lecture to a class because you can hear him writing on
the chalkboard.
You know, about the defending your faith. So it's like, I love listening to it, but because it doesn't match the book, it bothers me just a skosh.
I've seen segments of probably the same lecture on YouTube.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, then, you know, it's approaching it as it's a lecture instead of a book that makes it kind of a little easier to follow, probably.
Yeah. I do too. And I like the lecture. I just wasn't as an avid audiobook listener, you know. I like to be able to, when I'm in a book, I want to be able, and if I actually have the physical copy, like I do actually have the physical copy of Defending Your Faith, I want to be able to maybe pick it up at night when I can't listen to it and I can just read it and then to be able to go back and listen to it. But you can't do that when it's not the same.
And it's the kind of book you want to take little notes on too, and then, you know, go back and like look exactly what was said because it's not there.
So because I actually tried, I was like, maybe if I follow along then it'll make more sense, and it doesn't. I was like, I can't do this, it's making my brain hurt. So I just chose to just listen to it. So I listened to him, and I'm not gonna say it's slow going. You think by now I would have finished it, because I feel like I've talked about this book for about the last year and a half.
I don't have enough space to be an atheist on vacation last year.
I'm
still not through it.
I bought that book after we talked about it last year, and I haven't opened it. I actually did request that book on audio at the library, literally. Well, I feel like about a year ago. And I still don't have it because there's that many people waiting for it.
Wow.
There's like only one copy. Yeah. And I don't know how our library system works, but there's like only one copy of it.
Yeah.
So I've been waiting a while.
I really like, that's Norman Geisler and Frank Turk. And I really like them too. But like, they're a little, I mean, they've got a very evidential, but they're also very, like, because they're more like a classical method, I think. I hope I'm saying that correctly. But he gets a little more philosophy-ish. Which, like I said, it's needed. It's there. It's just a little. And that's the first part of it. It's a little bit harder to get through. I really enjoy the evidence. I mean, we talk about the cosmos. And
So basically too, I should say real quick, as a kind of a, to quote Steve, I'm going to back it up here. This is apologetics comes like straight from 1 Peter 3:15, you know, your goal is, and it's our goal always, something that I know we talk about a lot here and I talk about a lot outside of here. You know, our goal is to not choose sides. You know, we have to work, we want to be able to defend our faith, but with gentleness and respect. You know, you want to be able to have the ability to do that without, you know, without causing an argument, basically, or intentionally causing an argument.
Yeah. And then I think it's actually when I was listening from Boddy Bachman, you know, he also quotes Jude 3, "Beloved, although I was very eager to write to you about our common salvation, I found it necessary to write appealing to you to contend for the faith that was once for all and delivered to the saints." It says, "Because for certain people have crept in unnoticed who long ago were designated for this condemnation, ungodly people who pervert the grace of our God into sensuality and deny our only Master and Lord Jesus Christ. And I think that's, you know, why apologetics is so important. And, you know, very, very important to actually, you know, to teach our children too, mm-hmm. because it is quite easy to be led astray, you know.
Yeah.
How many, you know, kids in high school or, you know, part of the youth and who are, you know, excited and passionate, and then they get to college and, yes. you know, it's, I can't remember if it was written into, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. I think it was, but it talks about a friend whose daughter, who, you know, was very passionate and then was in college for a couple months and said, yeah, I think I'm an atheist. You know, it's important to know what you know. And to be able to see the evidence of it,
mm-hmm.
not just believe it because your mom told you to.
Yeah.
Or your pastor told you to.
Or it's what you've always done.
Yeah. Because more of that just, you know, more of a, you know, ritualistic or what you're used to.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Shall we jump into it?
Yeah.
I think, was going to say something. I'm sorry.
No. I was exactly what I was going to say. It's like, I think kind of the first point of evidence would be, it's almost the Bible. You can look at the texts, mm-hmm. you know, and since we've already quoted him twice, I'll quote him for a third time, or at least I'll paraphrase his quote because I couldn't find the exact one. I can find the first one, but I couldn't find the exact one I wanted. But, you know, Bodhi Bauckham said, I choose to believe the Bible because it's a reliable collection of historical documents written by eyewitnesses during the lifetime of other eyewitnesses, you know, and they report supernatural events that took place in fulfillment of specific prophecies that claim their writings are divine rather than human origin. And it's a collection of 66 books written over 1,500 years by 40 plus authors on three different continents in three different languages that tell a congruent account.
And I find it fascinating.
Yep.
Because just the New Testament alone, which I know we'll probably get into it a little bit more. Mm-hmm. I might be jumping ahead a little bit. But comparing it to the copies of, you know, the vast amount of copies. I mean, I think it's 5,800 handwritten Greek manuscripts of the New Testament and over 20,000 in other languages is estimated by comparing all those copies mm-hmm. that it is 99.5% accurate.
Yep.
Only 0.5% a mistake of hand copying these manuscripts.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I had heard, you know, there are people talk about how you don't have the originals. You only have the copies of the originals. But that's not, they're true, right? That's true.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
what the Bible was written on or what these original things were written on were not meant to sustain time. They weren't meant to like go for the long haul. It was literally written on parchment or sometimes, you know, as we kind of get into evidence or stone, but, you know, but that's not specific to just Christianity because the Muslims don't have their original copies. The Hindus don't have their original copies. Even the Jewish community, you know, don't have the original copies, which I know that kind of coincides with us too, but they, you know, but that's still the Old Testament. They don't have any of that as the originals. It's all copies upon copies. And people have said, you know, well, that could have been intentionally changed throughout the years. Okay. Well, think about all the copies that there are, you know, of the originals into the time, the man hours, the ability, like that even now would be hard to find.
And the different places they found them. It's not like they found them all in one place.
Yeah.
No, they found him in Egypt.
Yeah. You know, and then, and I know this also might be jumping it, but you have, you know, you talked about the, how the percentage of which they match, right? But, you know, you pull up when the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, you know, they were 1,000 years older than some of the oldest manuscripts that we have of our biblical text. And it matched what we have. You know, that alone is, it's amazing. Like any other time, if this wasn't about Christianity, if this wasn't about the Bible, if this wasn't about proving God, that would be hailed from the, you know, every media outlet ever. But because it is religious based and Christ based, you know, it's not as loudly, it wasn't as loudly proclaimed. Like, yes, I remember when the Dead Sea Scrolls, they were, you know, I don't even know if they still do this, but I remember going and seeing them in a in one of the museums in Michigan. And because they just had, you know, they had like an event and that's where they had brought them. I wish I had been as in awe of them as I probably should have been, you know, or at least to understand and read everything, to understand like the, how big of an opportunity that actually was to see those and to understand what they are. But that was 25 years ago ish, maybe even longer, you know? And so I didn't really have that understanding of even what they were.
Mm-hmm. You know, I remember hearing about the Dead Sea Scrolls and be like, oh, that's cool. But to understand the vastness of it and, and what the, just the evidence it had to prove, you know.
Yep.
The truth of it all. It's just mind-blowing. I love it apologetics. Is. I love this.
Yeah, this is just fun.
Yeah, it's talking about how many copies, you know, and like I said, this is just talking about the New Testament, not even talking about the Old Testament, but the, you know, what they do is they compare, because it's considered ancient text, so they compare other ancient texts. Now, they don't have any original from any ancient text.
Right.
The number of copies, the runner-up to the New Testament is the Iliad.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only 1,800 copies compared to the 5,800 that was just in Greek of the New Testament.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just amazing.
It is.
And then, like, another thing that they talk about, I don't have enough faith to be an atheist, is to also compare how the years between the oldest copy to the what the original would have been, and the New Testament blows every other ancient text out of the water there too.
Yeah.
It was saying that the oldest, this is undisputed. This is, you know, they say, okay, this is for sure. We're not even questioning it. Was a copy found in, it's a segment from John 18, 31 through 33 and 37 through 38. And it was found in Egypt. And it's dated between 117 and 138 AD. Those are called the John Rylands fragment. And so that's what, not even 100 years after Christ died. Well, right there at 100 years when he would have died, but less than 100 years to what it would have been written. And then they said there's non-disputed fragments that they're still kind of questioning that was found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And they said there's a possibility those even dated back to 1570 AD. Wow. That's just like very close.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, those are not saying without a doubt that's what it is, but it's just pretty interesting.
It is. It's very interesting, you know, and people will point out like that, the end of Mark, where it's a footnote saying, we're not sure if this is actually included in Mark, you know, mm-hmm. as saying, well, you see here, you guys have it where it's, you know, you guys can't even decide on how this book should end. And it's like, but you know, one of the podcasts I was listening to, they mentioned, and it's from a church that's over in like, I think it's in Lebanon, Tennessee, because they're over by Nashville. You know, they mentioned that should actually provide you a little bit more faith in your Bible, in the, like all of the texts that we have, because we can say, here's all the evidence that we have. This is all the documents. This one just doesn't quite fit, kind of like the way that everything else does, but we're going to put it here because it's still a part of it, but yet we weren't, you know, it's just, it's a little different sounding than what, like the, what we have, you know? So it's like, it's giving you, it should give you faith that you have enough evidence or you have enough context to be able to say like, this fits, but just doesn't always like it's disputed, you know, like you have enough to be able to take a look at that with discernment.
Yeah. And I like that the, when the Bibles do that, because I mean, to me, it just gives it more truth to it, you know, that this is not made up.
Right. And it's the same thing, you know, you'll hear people talk about the Gospels, how they're different. You know, sometimes they'll talk about the same account just differently, you know, but you always, again, you have to take into consideration who it was written for, who it was written by, you know, you and I can go to the same event and take something out of it differently. And what I might say about it isn't going to be the same thing that you're going to say about it.
Yeah.
And that's what, even with sermons at church, we were talking about the sermon yesterday around the fire last night. And my dad was like, yeah, when Doug talked about this, and I'm like, I don't remember Doug saying that. And I'm like, I don't feel like I dozed off. You know, I don't feel like I wasn't paying attention. I was taking notes, but Dad said, I don't remember what it was, but Dad was like, yeah, when Doug talked about this, and I was like,
yeah,
you know? And so again, it's just what God is speaking to you or what your message needs to be. And you're trying to focus on your audience too, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point. Cause you know, like, cause Matthew, he's talking to the Israelites, right?
Yeah. The Jewish community.
Yeah. And then, you know, Paul, his writings are to the Gentiles, you know? Luke and Mark, they weren't there, but they've interviewed people and they've gotten eyewitnesses account. So, you know, that's different viewpoints and pulled into one. Yeah, he was talking about they going back to the oldest manuscript found. We was talking about, you know, the New Testament is very, very close. And the closest thing to rival that is, again, the Iliad. And it was 500 years. The oldest copy was 500 years after it was originally written. So it's kind of like God said, hello, there's no way to deny this is my word. It's even, you know, kind of talking about how, sorry, I feel like I'm jumping all the way around. You can tell I'm excited about this topic. But it's how they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, you know? It was shards. They threw a rock into a cave. That's how they found it.
I actually don't think I knew that.
And let's see. I wrote something about it. It was found in 1947 by shepherds on the western side of the Dead Sea. And they found over 800 documents. And then another place I looked said it was over 900. So, I mean, there's a lot of information they're going through. But this is another thing. I watched a video, and they were talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they showed a newspaper clipping from the Wall Street Journal, I think, I'm hoping I'm telling this right, from 1952 with a advertisement to sell.
Oh my gosh.
Dead Sea Scrolls. Can you imagine?
No. Oh my gosh, no. But I know a lot of that stuff, that was big back then. Like, they used to sell, and they might even still, but I'm not on that market, but they used to sell mummies. You know, it was a very prestigious thing to have stuff like that. So I wouldn't run past it.
Yeah.
But
yeah. Cause you see a lot of like the, like the nobility in England, who they own so many artifacts from Egypt and from different dig sites. Yeah.
You know, and I think it would be hard to, you know, if we had the originals, if we had stuff like that, like, it would be hard not to almost have the people idolize stuff like that. Like, oh, we have the original. This is completely God divined, or this is exactly what Luke said, or this is Moses talking to, like, God talking to Moses. And so you have all of that. And just like the Ark of the Covenant, like, if we actually legitimately knew where it was, not a lot of, there's a lot, so many conspiracy theories, but you know, if we actually knew where it was, like, you can't tell me that people wouldn't start putting that up on a pedestal, and they would take that as a, almost like a Mecca thing, where you would be going to that, like, it would almost be like, now I know for a fact I'd want to see it. I know I would, you know, and to put that as, and not making that an idol, I think would be hard.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I think that's why we don't have a lot of those type of things. You know, like, you know, you think of, what's that movie with Harrison Ford?
Indiana Jones.
Indiana Jones and, you know, the chalice.
Yeah.
It would. I think there's a very good reason why we don't have those things did not survive.
Yeah, I agree. And, or if they did, we just don't know where they are.
Yeah. And, you know, not even go to saying of the same of like the actual original copies of the New Testament and Old Testament. Would we make those idols?
Yeah. I think we would. I really think, just because it's human nature, I think we would full on be the Israelites with Aaron, you know, and instead of a calf, we would have the Ten Commandments, the original Ten Commandments, or the Old Testament, or the New Testament up on a pedestal.
Yeah, I think so too.
And I I think that's something that, you know, I think it's something that that God knows about us, and it's a downfall. So, I mean, I think it's a good thing that we don't have that specifically, but to know that they're there and we have copies, you know.
Yeah. Even, you know, what was it in the 80s or 90s with a piece of toast that looked like Jesus or something that people started worshiping?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. That's a vague memory for me, but now, I remember that.
I saw that on Unsolved Mysteries or something.
Yeah, something. Yeah.
It's enough to leave an impression. I just hate the whole thing. But yeah, it's just the vast information that's out there that's just the same. It's just, you know, he's talking about how, you know, taking the different copies of the New Testament, it's 99.5%. You know, accurate. And of the 150,000 variants known, this is a Philip Scaliff. He was a scholar in his day that was known. Only 400 changed the meaning of the passage. Only 50 of those differences was of real significance. and not even one infected an article of faith, our precept of duty, which is not abundantly sustained by others. And I doubted passages are by the whole tenure of scripture teaching. So of all the, and I mean, that's 100, you get that 0.5% difference that they mm-hmm. found in the New Testament is 150,000 differences, you know?
Yeah.
That's huge. That just shows you how much they're comparing. Yeah. And then, you know, of that, not even one changes that what is
like the meaning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and it kind of compares some of the other ancient texts, and you know, we had 99.5% accuracy with the New Testament. Hindu manuscript was 90%. Homer's Iliad was 95%. I mean, it's just, it's way out there in front of everything yeah. else.
So along with the Bible and all of just kind of the obviously the amazingness that comes with the fact that we have it to this day, but we have a lot of the physical and the archaeological evidence as well that coincides. So you have the Bible and you have these evidences that prove the Bible. So that's kind of why I thought, you know, we start with the Bible, we say this is our foundation, and then it's kind of like this is our belt of truth, right? And now we're let's go into everything else so you can run the evidence through your belt of truth, like with the armor of God, you know. I mean, and I'm there's you have the Moabite stone or the Mesha Stela, which is a, you know, 9th century, like a BCE inscription that details like the victory of the king Mesha of Moab over the kingdom of Israel. So it's a story, you know, that is paralleled and provides like the Moabite perspective on mm-hmm. all the events that happened in 2 Kings, you know, and that was found in 1868.
And that I found that fascinating too, because mm-hmm. it's taking that perspective of our enemy and they're comparing the same battle.
Yeah.
It's just like, hello.
I mean, it's just, it's very cool because then again, it's something that it's a non-biblical text proving biblical events.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a phrase that I'm going to say more than once, yeah. But that's the whole point. Here is something mm-hmm. that is not in the biblical canon, that isn't widely known, that is proving events that occurred in the Bible.
And you know, to kind of go along with that, even just different historical historians that's not Christians, ancient historians, how much of those mentioned figures in the Bible, talks about mm-hmm. Jesus, talks about different biblical characters,
mm-hmm.
you know, probably shouldn't say characters because they're real, but people.
Oh, yeah, but it's hard because we both read books, so it's like they're characters in a book for us, but they're real people. Like there is this historical book, but they're still subjects.
Yeah,
subjects of the book, part of the plot. You know.
Yeah, which I think I think we have talked about before. One of the, you know, one that's kind of a little bit well known is Josephus.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and he was a Jewish slave to the Romans who was captured right before the fall of the siege of Jerusalem in 70 AD when the temple was destroyed. But he became a historian for one of the emperors. And you know, he talks about Jesus and he talks about some of the disciples and I think Amy talks about how John was martyred. He was stoned.
Not John.
Is it John? James.
James, but and that's also he also talks about Peter too, like he that's how we know how Peter died and Paul. And while we're on the subject of Josephus, you have one of the things that one of the evidences and one of the topics that people will say was that there's not a lot of evidence in the Bible or outside of the Bible that confirm that the, you know, the Amalekites actually were a tribe. Like there's not a lot of historical artifacts. There's not a lot of little things that they can find or even mentions of them. But so it was this, I wanted to make sure at least it was talked, because I looked, I'm like, okay, some of the things I said were like, oh yeah, now there's a whole bunch of like, now there's evidence. I'm like, where, you know? So I'm looking up, you know, at the, like the Biblical Archaeology Institute or, you know, other museums, like trying to finding like biblical museums, trying to see where I can find the evidence. And I couldn't find a lot either. But Josephus mentions it. Like he mentions the Amalekites, and they coincide with, again, the biblical events. And I know Josephus, you know, still, you had the you know, he was writing the Antiquities of the Jews, you know, so it, that mentions them in more than one book and more than one passage of just events that actually occurred for them. So it's still there. And whether or not the Amalekites were called the Amalekites in that era, or if they were called something a little bit different, and it's kind of been changed through our translations, you know, it is something that's full Liz thought process. That's nobody else's thought process but mine. You know, I mean, it doesn't take away, and because the Amalekites are not the only tribe that we don't have a lot of evidence for, but we know historically that they existed. It was just, you know, it's just one of the things that people try to use against us, against Christianity, that to try to disprove it. But again, it's looking at, to take the big picture, like, okay, we can say that, okay, there's not a lot here, but there's also not a lot for this tribe or that tribe or, you know, this other one, you know, or there's even tribes I'm sure that we don't even know about.
Yeah. You know, it, talking about Josephus, and says, including Josephus, there are 10 known non-Christian writers who mention Jesus within 150 years of his life. Actually, they say, you know, the emperor of the time, Tiberius, Jesus is mentioned more in these ancient texts than he is.
Yep.
Which I found just fascinating. But, you know, through those, like, 10 different texts, you know, some of the stuff that was mentioned in them is that, you know, Jesus lived during the time of Tiberius Caesar. He lived a virtuous life. He was a wonder worker. He had a brother named James. He was acclaimed to be the Messiah. He was crucified under Pontius Pilate. He was crucified on the eve of the Jewish Passover. Darkness and an earthquake occurred when he died. His disciples believed he rose from the dead. His disciples were willing to die for their belief. Christianity spread rapidly as far as Rome. His disciples denied the Roman gods and worshipped Jesus as God. And then, you know, even going a little bit farther, you know, we look at some of the early church fathers, you know, citing as early as 95 AD, 107 AD, 110 AD. We look at some of these, and they, it says that they quote so much of the New Testament, so much of Matthew, so much of Mark, Luke, Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, Ephesians, 1st, 2nd Timothy, Titus, Hebrews, James. It says you could almost just by their quotes write the whole New Testament. You know, and you know, that's copies they have.
Yeah.
But I thought that was really interesting.
It is very interesting. Okay, so we also have, well, guess real quick again. So with the Moabite stone, so it is the first or the earliest known extra biblical reference to God's holy name, like Yahweh. Like that's the first, like the earliest writing that actually calls him that too, which I thought was important because it's like a very historical non-biblical reference, you know, that just, again, calls him by that name. And you also have, you know, they found the silver scrolls, which are named that because they're written on literal silver. So, you know, when the researchers from the Israel Museum in Jerusalem unrolled the sheets of silver, they found tiny lines of the ancient Hebrew script that was inscribed on them. So they had to take the high resolution photos of the miniature writings. And that was in 1994, you know, just by the West Semantic Research Project at the University of Southern California. But they were researchers like the ability and the opportunity to kind of decipher kind of what that Hebrew text was, and basically ended up being inscriptions dating to the 86 centuries BCE, which contained blessings that similar to the ones that were found in Numbers.
I want to say too, is that the one that took them quite a long time to actually unroll
because of
how old it was.
Well, how old, and just the fact that it was written on silver, and they kind of determined that it really was something that it wasn't probably meant to be read. You know, it was something that somebody had written down, but it wasn't something that it was like supposed to be. You know, some scrolls and some blessings are read out loud. Like, this wasn't one of them.
Yeah, I had written, they took over 3 years to unroll.
Mm-hmm.
And the first word they were able to read was Yahweh of those scrolls. The first word they were actually able to decipher was Yahweh. And I know another one they found was the Tel Dan inscription.
Mm-hmm.
With the what it says is the house of David, and it dates back to the 9th century BC. And I thought it was interesting was because it was sealed by an Assyrian destruction layer dated from 733 to 722 BC. So it shows what was written is older than that because it was sealed.
Yep.
And it's just kind of like God's way of preserving these old evidence.
Yeah, with it being like the only, like the first and only, almost pretty much almost the only other biblical text that actually shows that King David not only existed, but it talked because of the way that it talked about him, it was how they the defeat of, you know, the Davidic dynasty, like all the kings of the house of David, like that's is showing you again of all of the things that, again, that we know occurred, you know, but proving again that the Bible is matching up with the history. And I remember watching years ago, it was since we've lived in this house. So within the last 6 years we watched, and I want to say it was probably Josh Gates, you know, about this. And it, you know, I remember him going and they were talking about, because they were kind of like, it was like the search for David kind of, and I don't know, remember what the one was. And I can't be 100% that it was like Expedition Unknown, like with Josh Gates or something that he's done. But that's usually who we watch when we're watching. I do too. It's like he makes it interesting.
Yeah.
But I remember them talking about that, and, you know, talking about how this is the only written evidence that we have that King David actually existed, and it's and his lineage, his line, his kings, you know, after that. That was just, it is extremely, extremely interesting. Then you have like that in the same aspect too, you have the, and so if I kill it, I apologize, I'll spell it afterwards. But it's the Mernpeta stela. So the Merneptah. So it's a monument from the 1200 BC that talks about Israel as a nation. And it's an account of that their victory over the ancient, like the Libyans and all of their allies. But, you know, the last three of like the 28 lines deal with the separate campaign in Canaan, like part of Egypt's, like their possessions. And so it's something that sometimes is referred to as the Israel Stela, because a majority of the scholars translate it as like a set of hieroglyphs in line 27 is Israel. So it's like, it's a point, they're pointing to the Israelites as a nation, as a separate tribe, and just kind of just reaffirming the fact that they were around and that they were as prominent as they were.
Mm-hmm. And that's from Egypt, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, shows they knew them, shows them they were there.
Yeah.
So.
And the same thing with the Cyrus cylinder. You have from the Babylonian king, Cyrus, you know, mm-hmm. it's his documents that is talking about the Israelites coming, like he's releasing them out mm-hmm. of captivity. And so that's, you know, that's when they start leaving Babylon, going into back to Jerusalem.
It's just, yeah. It's fascinating because it just points out one thing after another, after another, after another, showing how accurate
mm-hmm.
you know, the Bible is.
And I know this one I didn't really know about until Steve started talking about it. And I looked it up. Well, obviously, you know, you look stuff up, but you know, for Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, they, and that's a kind of a little bit more of a recent thing, because it's saying its discovery made international headlines in 2021, which shocked me because it's not been that long. I feel like I would have remembered this.
I didn't either.
So, you know, but they're saying like that, you know, there's been so much evidence that's been uncovered that they can see that some kind of appeared to have been like a bombing occurred that completely wiped out the city like instantaneously, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like the chemical analysis, it basically said that their temperatures had to have briefly spiked to the levels approaching that of the surface of the sun.
That is insane.
It's insane. And it says like embedded throughout the, you know, Erregite strata of the southwestern Dead Sea nations too, there's numerous miniature sulfur balls that can be found. So you have all of, again, this physical evidence of where Sodom and Gomorrah was, even though there's obviously always going to be like, you can't prove that.
Yeah.
No, but how many other cities were literally smited by fire?
Yeah.
From heaven.
That is mentioned. And we just found evidence.
Yeah.
And you know, it's remind me to never get on the wrong side of God. I really want to be on the side of God.
I don't really need that to happen.
But you know, you'd look at different, just so many archaeological sites.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they found the walls of Jericho and evidence mm-hmm. of the collapse of the city walls.
That's that was one of my favorites.
Yeah,
because it's so cool because the way the walls fell. You know, they fell out, not in. So it shows it was like an implosion and not somebody coming into the city.
Yeah. They're not firing upon the city.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. And then, you know, they found part of a wall still standing. And everything I was saying, well, that was the supposed where Rahab was. Well, who else would it have been?
Yeah, exactly. She survived, and we know that her house or her apartments were on the wall.
Exactly. You know, and you know, they talk about how you can see the burn line in the grain. You know, they're still finding sustenance, you know, like from that era where and pottery and everything. Whereas if they were under siege, if that city was, you know, attacked, Mm-hmm. Plunder is normally taken. Like, people take stuff. Yeah. Like, that's what you do. Or when you're fleeing a city, you take your things. Yes. You know, that's not what happened, because God told Israelites, you're not taking any of it.
Yeah.
You know.
And I don't know about you. If I lived in a tribe that was kind of close to that, and I saw what God did there, I'd be like, I don't think I'm going to go near there.
Yeah, I think I'm good.
I don't want anything from that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they found, because a lot of people's question whether Pontius Pilate existed, and now they found an inscription of Pontius Pilate.
That's right.
I think that, don't quote me on this, but I think that's kind of a recent find, too. That might not be right.
I'm not positive. I'll be honest on that one.
And stuff all confused in my head, and I didn't write it down. So,
well, this is just one of the best things about, this is why I knew that there'd be things that you went through and things that I went through, because, and that's so why there is. And I knew that we'd have some of the same stuff when we were looking at it, because we have a lot of the same interests. And I know that, you know, you would dive deeper in other things than I would, you know, and this is, I mean, we're still just touching the surface of evidences that can coincide with exactly what the Bible said.
Oh yeah. You know, another thing that I saw that, in Acts, in the last 16 chapters of Acts alone, there are 84 facts that has been confirmed by historically and archaeologically found finds that can only show that, you know, Luke was there. I mean, he is very descriptive. And people did not travel that much, you know?
They were walking, you know, they were on donkeys.
Yeah. And then a lot of this is, you know, they didn't even know until they found these archaeological sites. I mean, I don't have a specific instance, but it's just fascinating, I think.
It is. You know, and you still have, Hezekiah's tunnel too. That's it's referenced in Second Chronicles, you know, but it's a water channel that's in Jerusalem that was built around 700 BC by King Hezekiah. You want to talk about not being able to speak.
That's a hard one.
Goodness. King Hezekiah. I just got to go slower. My mouth just wants to spit it out, but I can't. To supply water from the Gihon spring to the pool of Siloam, preventing the Assyrian army from cutting off their water supply, you know, during a siege. And so it's a 1,750 foot long tunnel, you know, and it's in itself, they're saying it's an engineering marvel, because it's teams were working from one side to the other and met in the middle at that day and age. I mean, shoot, the math that had to go into that. Thank you very much. I couldn't do, you know, but it's confirmed by like the inscriptions and the tunnel dating and everything. So it's still there. You can still see it. So that's, again, that's something that you see in our biblical text, in our canon, in the Old Testament, that's still there now. Even there now, like, that's not like they didn't just dig it out, or it's not just like a site that you can see. It's something that is still within the walls.
It is. It's just, you know, we just kind of covered the, like what we talked about, you know, the historical evidence, the historical texts, the historical places, archaeology, you know, we didn't even get close to covering all of it.
No.
And, you know, it's just so amazing just how much is out there. You know, we didn't even get into the cosmos, you know, that's evidential stuff too. And
I mean, you have Assyrian texts, Babylonian texts, Egyptian texts that all mentioned in their documents that prove historical context in the same way, in the same lineage, like the same timeline as the Bible. You know, some of the Assyrian texts go back to 700 to 800 years before Christ and talk about biblical kings by name and in the right time frame, again, in the right order. And it's not like these people could be sitting next week. This isn't something
that they were enemies.
Yeah, they were enemies. They were people that it's not like they're sitting in the same classroom looking over the shoulder saying, hey, what are you writing over there?
Yeah.
Let me see it. Let me just match what you have. You know, this is all standalone documents that prove one another. But all that, so everything being said, everything looking at all just the minute, even though I personally think we brought a lot to the table. We are putting forth a lot of evidence that we just found. And this is still not everything. We might be deeper than surface because this is interesting to both of us. And it's something that we both are passionate about. And I think that it's not that you ever want to, you always want to have faith like a child, right? You always want to make sure that you know you believe God and you know he's going to do what he says he's going to do, even though it's impossible, right? That's what faith like a child is. But having this type of knowledge base, this evidence is just, it's helpful because it helps, it helps you feel validated in your faith. It helps you to be able to share your validation and to be able to say like, okay, hey, you don't believe that, that's fine. But here, look this up, compare this to this, you know? And again, so in a way that you're doing it with gentleness and respect. So we wanted to make sure that we're helping equip others, you know, to have the ability or even to spark that desire to look into this, you know, something that Steve mentioned, and I thought it was worth mentioning too, was that, you know, Israel covers 0.015% of the world's total land area. And we have this much evidence of their existence, you know, which is insane. It's like, it's insane how to have just that small of a tribe and we have all of this evidence still, you know. Because how many tribes out there, again, we talked about it earlier, I guess, with the Amalekites, how many tribes out there do we have that existed that could have, that were likely bigger, that could have been bigger, and we have nothing. You know, we don't have even half of any of that.
Oh, yeah. You know, the Egyptians, they have quite a bit of historical evidence and stuff, but they were a pretty large mass, you know? Yeah. But there's also so many different tribes and stuff that they conquered and they squashed, you know, and then we will never know them.
Yeah.
But like you said, the Israelites, a very small, really a very small group. And you know, how many different other, you know, cultures like the Egyptians and like the Assyrians and, you know, knew them.
Yeah. And not even just knew them, but documented their existence and fought them and lost and
or won,
you know, but you know, there's just so much evidence of their existence, which is just shouldn't be.
Yeah. And how many times were they taken away from their land, you know?
Yep.
And always God showed them to return back to it.
Yeah.
Even very recently.
Yeah.
So just, I mean, and just to think, you know, a nation that really is culturally hated, you know, and worldly, I guess I should say, and the eyes, you know, we know the Romans didn't like them. We know the Egyptians didn't like them, you know, and that's from ancient texts. And, but most recently, you know, you had the Holocaust, you know, it just shows how important this group of people are.
Yeah.
I mean, cause they would not continue to exist if God did not see it that way.
Exactly. Exactly. So we highly recommend that you guys, I mean, I know we mentioned a bunch of books and we mentioned a bunch of like texts and websites and everything that we kind of found a lot of our information from. So we just, we encourage everybody to look into that and tell us what you find. What did you guys find interesting? Like what kind mm-hmm. of sparked you to look into what, and what did, you know, and we look forward to going through the rest of apologetics and everything with you guys, but to kind of go on this journey, because it not only helps us in it, but you know, we're trying to equip you guys to be able to do exactly what we're called to do, you know, and it's just, again, it's defending your faith. So with that, we will see everybody next time.
We want to thank you all for listening to the Mustard Seed Podcast and for joining us on this journey that God laid on our hearts. I know it's hard to feel connected when we are on this side of the microphone, so we wanted to make sure that you knew that you could connect with us on Facebook and Instagram at the Mustard Seed Podcast. Our Facebook group is a community. We share funny memes, Bible verses, and just life. You can reach out however you feel comfortable. We want to build the community that we advocate for on this podcast, the Come As You Are. Our table will never be too crowded and cannot get too big. You belong here, and we want to connect with you.